Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today we're going to take a look at something I've never discussed before, but I have been digging into history for other purposes, which I will still tell you about. The interview you're about to hear is one between myself and a scholar in Europe called Dr. Christian Lindner. And Lindner has a very interesting set of ideas, which is the result of decades of work that he did in Sanskrit. And I just want to give you a little bit of background here, because what we've got here is some extremely interesting white history, European history. There was a time between 1,000 and 1,500 years before Christ, when whites invaded and conquered India. And these whites were known as the Aryans. Now, those whites got up to all kinds of things in India, including instituting the first ever form of apartheid. I kid you not. The most successful form of apartheid ever invented was invented by the whites who conquered India. And it's one of many topics that we're going to get back to. Now, there is a link between India and Europe, and it's got to do with whites who've headed off to India to do things. But there is another time when whites also got to India, and this is before the British got to India. And this was when Alexander the Great, the king of Macedon, basically Greece in that time, he ended up conquering all of Greece, and his original state was Macedon. Now, Alexander the Great, about 300 years before Christ, headed off to go and smash the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire had been a big nuisance for the Greeks, and the Greeks decided to crush them. And Alexander the Great pulled off an incredible feat. But Alexander set off many things, and it's been quite interesting for me to pick up some of the things that Alexander actually kicked off. So as we dig into some of the past history of whites, you're going to see some pretty weird things. So let me just try and explain this to you. Alexander the Great also conquered into ancient Egypt. That is the Egypt of the pyramids. And one of the consequences of that is that Greeks and Romans, in other words whites, ended up also ruling ancient Egypt for a period of time. Can you believe? But it gets even weirder. Alexander the Great smashes the Persians and heads off to India. Eventually, his soldiers just don't want to go any further because he's just conquering and conquering and he doesn't know when to stop. And he ends up in India. And it's possible that he was taught by his tutor Aristotle that he should go out and conquer the world and bring Greek civilization to the world. This is very similar to what Christians later claimed they were doing. We whites in Africa, we for example believed that we had come to Africa and part of our mission was to civilize all these peoples. But you'll find out that Alexander the Great did the same thing much, much earlier, before Christianity even existed. And he even left scholars there. A large number of scholars and other people went with him to India. And it seems that these whites got up to all kinds of things. They went and started educating people. And their goal was to pass on their civilization to all these other people. However, it may be that some of the civilization that whites kicked off in India may actually have come back not only to the Western world, but also to China. And When you start digging into ancient history, I got to tell you, it just gets stranger and stranger, and it gets more fascinating than you can believe. Now, this impromptu chat that I had with Dr. Lindner was actually arranged by NS Viking, and those of you in Europe will know exactly who I'm talking about. So I just want to thank NS Viking for this awesome intro. This is really fascinating. Now, some of you will know that I've spoken about my Boer Nazi pal in the past. He was a university lecturer here in South Africa, and he lectured in scientific method. And it was interesting in my discussions with Dr. Lindner how there are things that my Boer Nazi pal told me that he can confirm from his own viewpoint in Europe. As you will see, whites in different parts of the world have been discovering things, and many times those discoveries are actually very similar. However, it's just that whites have been kept apart and whites have not been talking to each other, and when they do, you're going to find some really interesting things. So here is my interview with Dr. Lindner. Welcome, yeah. Dr. Lindner. It's an honor to have you on my show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and you have invited me to talk about my discoveries in the field of...
You know what? Thanks to our friend NS Viking and the excellent work that they do, I learned about you today, and I've got to talk to you. Just in our little prior discussion to this, it was just fascinating to hear the things that you've uncovered. So yeah. I think the main point that I want to start with is you're basically talking about the link between India and the Europeans. And I've had a quick look at your website, Jesus is Buddha, and we're going to get to that stuff. But in your discussions, you said to me that Alexander the Great is really the start of this because the timing of this matches the time, and I'm a big fan of Alexander the Great. I know that he invaded and conquered all the way from Greece right into India in 300 BC. So can you give me some info on Alexander and what did he do and what did it kick off?
Yes, it seems he was, we may start with his being a pupil, a student of Aristotle. And to put it very briefly, Aristotle may have encouraged Alexander to conquer the world and bring Greek culture to the barbarians, roughly. Ah. It seems to be the idea. Okay. And eventually, Alexander then does so on a huge, very huge and amazing, ever amazing basis. And partly he then travels east, partly in order to take revenge over the Persians for their having burnt down the temple of Athene on the Parthenon, early Parthenon temple, and Athens Acropolis. So before he leaves for the east, he puts up the spoils and pays his respects to the goddess Athene. You might say then that the first place we want to start before we undergo or start our travel to the east would be up on the Acropolis of Athens, where we have the temples, the temple for Athene Parthenos, the Virgin Athene. We also have a temple of Athena Nike, the Athena as conqueress or victory, Athena as victory, and a few other temples. He believed, Alexander, in the goddess Athene. We should not be really amazed, because most Greeks would believe in Athene. Athene was the daughter of Zeus, who was called, in the earliest piece of literature in Greek, the daughter, the beloved daughter of Zeus, who was our heavenly father, the heavenly father of all men and gods. And he was the enthroned up on the sky, up in the sky, up in the heavens, which was almost the same as up on the mountain Olympus. So here we have Alexander, who believed in this goddess of Athene. And material proof, anyone who has taken a bit of interest in ancient Greek coinage, and I would really recommend that you look at Greek coins from around 500 BC. There, in all likelihood, you will find a Greek coin which has Athene or her father on the reverse. And so this was any Greek such as Alexander and Greeks before him and after, they would believe in Zeus and his beloved daughter. So what Alexander was bringing with him in his heart and in his mind would be this ancient Greek religion. And we can see when we read the Greek historians that when he celebrates a victory of some sort, he would set up an altar for Athene, a column for Athene, Macedonian lions in her honor. That is sort of where we begin. And at first he conquers the Persian Empire totally, and eventually considers himself as a new king of kings. And then he comes to India finally, and there are some wonderful films about this the Alexander story by various English scholars. So that's where we start. But then he comes to India, and his soldiers find that it's time to go back. They have had enough. It has been extremely exhausting travel. He has founded about 30 cities called Alexandria. So now we are in India around 325, and he is not able to go on. But he would have liked, there is nothing that he would have loved more than to conquer India. The historians tell us about the Indian barbarians, and the Greeks are, or Macedonians, it's better to say Macedonians, they are always curious, and Alexander brought all these scientists and scholars with him, and they are simply so eager to learn what this unknown part of the world has to offer. So this, there are...
If I may interrupt you, I didn't know that Alexander took scientists and scholars with him. That is very interesting, because the only other instance that I know of a conqueror taking scientists with him is Napoleon when he went to Egypt.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes, but that would be, the Greeks are really always curious. And at the time of Alexander, remember, Greek science had been flourishing for a very long time. Let's go back to the 6th century with Pythagoras and all the temples, geometry, mathematics, astronomy, astrology. So it was a highly flourishing culture that was being brought to India. So this is where we...
The best of the Europeans.
So, yes. And what did he find in India? Or rather, we are now here speaking of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Is that where he was?
There he met the first Indians. And these were very odd people, some of them like these strange people who were standing on one leg for a month and looking up in the sun, or behaving in various odd ways. So the Greeks were very fascinated by these strange people, the Indians, but it's also clear that the Greeks would consider them to be barbarians. But they were very fascinated, the Greeks. And then in my view, Alexander decided somehow to leave some of his people, soldiers and scientists, scholars, as he had done before in Persia, and let them bring Greek culture, Hellenistic culture, to the Indians. And that's where the story begins.
Okay.
And I think there's a coherent picture here. And then our first real certain piece of chronological evidence is provided by the inscriptions of King Ashoka. King Ashoka. A-S-A-S-A-S-O-K-A. Ashoka. Around 250 BC. And here we are on very good, firm chronological ground. Because Ashoka has left an enormous amount of monuments and pillars in stone with inscriptions. And these inscriptions one can read, and that I had to read when I did my exams in Greek and in Sanskrit and in Pali in 1979, I think it was, right? So we can read these inscriptions, and that's where you want to begin, Jan. Ashoka, he is then the first proponent of Buddhism that we know, King Ashoka. Okay. And he mentions that he has sent out missionaries or ambassadors to the kings in the West. And he mentions Egypt, Macedonia, Epirus, and Syria. So around 250 BC, there are links of communication on the highest level are in existence. And we have a legend about King Ashoka's father. He would like to order and order a couple of Greek philosophers. And then we have the answer from the Greek king. Well, we don't sell philosophers, but let's see what we can do.
Wow.
And that, of course, that shows for sure that the Indians also were curious and wanted to learn more about Greek culture.
Wow.
That is really, here we are on firm ground, because as I said, his monuments are in stone and they are still available here. These monuments were discovered about in 1870s and 60s, right? And then some of my predecessors here in Denmark were among the first to figure out what these inscriptions really say. And when I was in the university, I still had to read, and I translated these inscriptions into Danish myself. So here you have the first really picture of Buddhism. And what is Buddhism?
If I may interrupt you, I was under the mistaken impression that Buddhism was thousands of years old, but you're saying that Buddhism only predated Christianity by a short period of time.
That is what I'm saying. And most people, most listeners, they will say, well, that's not true. But then they need to see that I already did a work on this in 1982. I have been considering this matter very, very seriously, because I grew up, along with my colleagues, believing that Buddha lived around 500 BC up in the Himalaya mountains.
Yes.
But I will tell you why I have changed my mind. And that is, Ashoka's inscriptions then are the first pieces of literary evidence. Then around 200 BC, I would say, we have the first scriptures. Not in Sanskrit, but in the other major ancient Indian language called Pali. P-A-L-I. Pali. You can look that up. And it is an enormous amount of literature, several shelves. And here in Denmark, where I'm sitting, we were the first to really to study the Pali language scientifically. At one time, I was working in the Danish Royal Academy of Sciences, along with some colleagues from Germany, doing the critical Pali dictionary. And I'm saying this to make it very clear that I am working on the texts, reading in the original language.
Right.
So I don't have... Everything comes out from my own view of the text and discussing with colleagues. You see, we go to really to the primary sources. We don't have any preconceived ideas.
Yes.
And then at one point, not so long ago, Jan, I discovered that there were references to Greek, the Greek language and Greek geometry in these early writings.
Oh, wow.
And that was quite decisive. Then I talked to my colleagues very much about this, and we all agreed, well, everybody has told us that the Buddha, he lived a very long time ago, 500 or 600 years BC. But then we talked about it, and then it was impossible to explain how there was a Greek language and Greek geometry in at that such an early time. It was much simpler to say it came with Alexander.
Yes.
That's a common sense thing.
Because,
and combined with the
Because yes. I assume there's never been other evidence of anybody else coming up with geometry anywhere else in the world. It comes from the Greeks only.
Right. And the Greeks got it from the Egyptians. So that's another story. That okay. The Egyptians had a very, very old tradition of this. But geometry is well established among the Greeks from the 7th century BC. So it does come with the Greeks. Geometry and Greeks belongs together. Right. So it was pretty clear to me that the early Buddhist texts were influenced by the Greeks. And then there's a wonderful passage I discovered in early Buddhist texts. It goes as follows. The Buddha and his disciples are walking, strolling from city or village to village. Then they stop up in a close to a forest. And then one of these Buddhists, he looks at the trees, and then he can count the number of trees, of leaves. And he says, there are 6,572,355 leaves on that tree. And of course, all the monks are amazed and say, how in the world can he have such a skill? And then the Buddha says, I'll give you the explanation why he can count in a jiffy such huge numbers. This was because long time ago, in a distant country, he was reborn and he studied Greek astronomy.
Greek astronomy? Okay, you've and lost me a bit. Yeah?
And when you study Greek astronomy, it comes together with Greek music and with Greek arithmetic and with Greek geometry. They form a group of four. So you see, the early Buddhist texts themselves refer to a distant country a long time ago where you could study Greek geometry.
Okay.
Yes. And in view of this, I had to drop the old stories about Buddha living such a long time ago in the kingdom up in the mountains in the Himalayas. Simply, I would consider it a myth.
Okay.
These are my main arguments, right?
Okay, I'm with you. Right.
Right. And then when we come to the... So we have, let's say, 200 BC, and in the following centuries, we have so-called Buddhist Gospels. It is a gospel. There's a Sanskrit word meaning well said. And later on, we'll come back to the term gospel.
Okay.
Now, so I am an Indologist, and that is, I finished my study at the university in 1979, and then I did a doctoral dissertation, which is the most successful Danish doctoral dissertation ever. It's now in its 10th edition. It's
wow.
called Master of Wisdom.
Okay.
And it contains several new Sanskrit texts that I had discovered, philosophical works that I had discovered in China and in Mongolia, in India and in Tibet. So I was very fortunate that I could publish these things. So ever since then, I have been studying Indian and Buddhist philosophy
right.
and published a lot of books, as you can see there, and lectured in many places. Then, more than 20 years ago, something strange happened. Namely, I was reading the New Testament. I really had not much interest in Christianity here in Denmark. We are Protestants. Three out of four Danes are Protestants following the Reformation of Luther. And Lutheran Christianity was established in Denmark in 1536. So three out of four Danes would be Lutherans, but if you ask them, what does that mean? I think 9 out of 10 would say, no idea. Yeah, no idea. Okay. No idea. And if you actually go to one of the 2,000 churches here, you'll find that even our priests are very ignorant of what Christianity is.
Okay.
But I was reading then, out of curiosity, I was editing a book on Greek religion, on comparative religion, world religions. It's still a standard work. And then I discovered that one or two of these passages that I was reading in the Greek Testament, in fact, I had seen before. And it took some time for me to realize that I had seen these sentences in Sanskrit before.
Okay. And then the rest,
was really, it was really simple, the rest. Then each and every day for the last 20 years, I find new sentences in Sanskrit, in Buddhist scriptures, that have been incorporated into the New Testament. And the New Testament consists of 27 books. And to be sure, it's written in Greek. We have four Gospels, and then we have a book of Acts, and then we have a lot of epistles or letters, and then a strange book as number 27 of a book of Revelations. And okay. You can find in the Buddhist scriptures letters or epistles, you can find Revelations, and you can find Gospels.
And so now,
very simple when now it comes down.
Let me ask you this question. You are finding New Testament stuff in Sanskrit writings, in Sanskrit from India. Which then are the oldest?
Well, it's good that we started with King Ashoka. That was, as I said, the firm chronological starting point. And then the Buddhist scriptures come into being around 200 BC. And to be quite sure, then we have Buddhist art, paintings and sculptures from around the first century BC. We still have them. And there we can see stories of the Buddha's previous lives in stone. And then we can have some of the, we find some of these Indian things about 100 years later in Christianity. So the priority is for certain on the Indian side.
Oh, wow. So this was created in India, these Gospels and these texts.
Correct.
Can you give me some examples of them, and how were they used in Christianity? Did they just copy little bits and pieces? How tell me a bit more about how it was used.
Yeah. To be sure, our first, well, the document of Christianity is, of course, the New Testament,
right,
consisting, as we agreed, of four Gospels and other works, epistles, and so on. Okay. And typically, it is the story of the birth of Jesus and his preaching, his gospel, as it were. He expresses himself in parables, and he teaches us about the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heavens. He has this focus on kingdom. And then he has 12 disciples, just as Buddha often has 12 or 1,200 disciples.
Aha.
That is the general picture, that he is born more or less miraculously, then his wanderings, and then he passes away. Now, not too long ago, I discovered the episode of the crucifixion.
Yes? In Sanskrit?
In Sanskrit.
You're kidding
me. And I presented this at a conference, and it has been published in a book that I mentioned on my website by my colleague, now in his 80s, Professor Michael Lockwood. Lockwood, you can easily find the reference on my website. And Professor Lockwood, and on Amazon, he's retired professor of philosophy and religion in South India. And he also reads Sanskrit, and he discovered my work almost 10 years ago, and has written books about it. And he published my discovery of the crucifixion of Jesus. And Jan, it's easy for anyone who procures the book to see the Sanskrit text, and even if he does not read the Sanskrit, which is unlikely, then there's a literal English translation. And no one who reads it can fail to see that you here have the crucifixion, the original crucifixion story. So it's a...
This is quite mind-blowing, and because I have come across biblical stuff like Noah and the Ark that also comes from the Sumerians, where you can see a lot of similarities. But now I want to ask you, Why is this story told in India? Is there any understanding? So you're saying that all this stuff is what they came up with for the Buddha?
Yeah.
That the Buddha himself was crucified?
Yes. So we have no idea who the authors of the Buddhist scriptures in India are. They are anonymous. They typically say just, and on one occasion, the Buddha said so and so. We have no idea where they come from. No idea.
Okay.
And it's the same with the four Gospels of Matthew, of Mark, and Luke, and of John. They are first names. Matthew is the first name, Mark is the first name, John is the first name. We have no idea. No idea where they come from. So it is that they drop down from the sky. Exactly the same as the Buddhist scriptures. As the Buddhist scriptures. Only names. We have no idea who these people are. No idea. No idea. So they are anonymous.
But somebody in India created these things and published these things.
That is for sure.
And then these texts find their way into Christianity. But now the New Testament. When was the New Testament? What is the oldest version of the New Testament in Greek in the Western world?
Around 100 AD.
So we've got 300 years from the time that it takes to get from India to appear in the West. Very interesting.
You could argue like that. At this point, it is good to look at the Buddhist missionary activity in general. It started already in the 3rd century, but the Buddhist monks, we are dealing with learned monks who know the scriptures by heart. These are the people we want to focus on. And already in this 1st century, around 40 AD, the first monks, Buddhist monks, come from Central Asia to China. And they know, we have Chinese sources telling of these strangers with their huge, big noses. That's what the Chinese would speak of these foreigners, foreign barbarians. Okay, Buddhist monks came to China and eventually succeeded in establishing Buddhism in China with the help and support of the emperor. And that is around 40 AD. And it's more or less the same story in the West. Eventually, the Buddhist monks come to the Mediterranean areas.
In what years? Roughly when?
Yeah, wish we knew it. There is really no external evidence. All our speculation must be based on what we can infer from the New Testament itself. Now, the New Testament contains more than 300 quotations from the Old Testament. Everybody agrees on that.
Okay.
And then what our anonymous authors would be doing would be simply to link up the Buddhist materials with the Old Testament Jewish materials. So the Jewish myth is there and has been there for several centuries with Moses and Abraham and so on. And the Jesus figure we have is presented in the first verse of Matthew as the son of David and as the son of Abraham. And when Jesus has his Sermon on the Mount, he is a sort of a new Moses. In other words, the authors of the New Testament want to create the illusion that, oh, this is just a Jewish king who has somehow grown out of the Old Testament. And that is what we all learn when we study theology at a university, that he has grown, this Jesus, he is the Jew that had been expected for long, the Messiah. And
yes,
we only need the Old Testament, then everything can be explained. That is what we learned in school. That is what we learned in the universities. But now then, my awful discoveries, they disturb this picture. And I can tell you many stories of how disturbed and furious and confused the professors of theology have been. And I have been very active, going to knock the door of the bishop and going to the faculty of theology and so on and so forth, and telling my colleagues there, look, have a look at these Sanskrit texts. Here you have the sources of the crucifixion, of the Eucharist,
yeah,
of baptism, and many parables.
And it predates the Western stuff. So if I understand you correctly, the Buddhists sent out missionaries to China and also missionaries to the West.
That's right.
And you are thinking or suggesting that those missionaries came to the West to spread Buddhism to the West, but that it may have been picked up by the people in the West and turned into Christianity.
Or leveraged
into Christianity.
Yes, you have understood quite right, Jan. You might also put it in this way, that Christianity, in all its manifoldness, is Buddhism for the West.
Wow. You know what is kind of funny for me? Is that when I was young, everybody in our society was Christian, and I had no interest in Christianity. But can you believe I latched onto a sort of popularized version of Buddhism as the thing that became my sort of spiritual belief for much of my life. And it was actually related. It came from a guy who himself was actually a fake. I don't know if you've ever heard of the name Lobsang Rampa.
There are many Lobsangs, maybe even Rampa. I don't quite remember. Yes,
Lobsang Rampa was a guy in Britain who popularized Buddhism, and he wrote some strange books about UFOs and things, and being a Tibetan and everything. And when I was young, I latched onto his stuff. So it's kind of funny that Buddhism is actually somehow related to Christianity.
That is something.
So you think that they were trying to convert the Western world to Buddhism? That is for sure. Okay.
Yes, you might put it like that. It is, of course, very puzzling that they would not tell. They would not say, "We are Buddhists coming from India." No, that was not their intention.
Really?
Their intention was to smuggle Buddhism in so that no one noticed. I think we have to imagine the situation. Mainly, they were trying to convert Jews.
Are you serious?
Yes. So they and
Why
the Jews,
Jews,
of course, would.
Why?
Well, because that they are active among the Jews. I mean, the fictitious Jesus figure that the Gospels have created is constantly surrounded by Jews, the Pharisees, and the scribes. He's constantly among Jews. Now and then there's a Roman soldier, but he is really, and he teaches in the Jewish synagogue, right? Synagogue of Capernaum. So he is trying. It is a Buddha who is trying to become the Jewish king. That's what's going on.
Okay.
But he was not successful. But to some extent he was successful. To some extent he wasn't. You can speculate whether this entire enterprise was supported by the Romans. It may well be. There's an American scholar who argues that this was made up by the Roman Emperor Titus after the capture of Judea in year 70. But there may be a little bit of truth, but that hypothesis does not explain the fact that the Greek text is from a point of literature a copy of the Buddhist gospel. That said, that we only have two examples in world history of gospels, the Christian ones and the Buddhist ones. Nowhere else do we have gospels in the ancient world. So it's really very simple, once you are aware of it, that gospel becomes gospel, and Jesus is a new Buddha. Because the Buddhists, it's really misleading. Now I'm coming back to something else, Jan. We usually, of course, speak of the Buddha and Buddhism, but actually we should speak of the Buddhas in the plural. Because already the so-called historical Buddha says that I have many predecessors. First, there are six previous Buddhas, and perhaps there are millions before me. So it starts out, he is just our present Buddha. So it was very natural for the Buddhist monks as missionaries went to China, when they went to China, they invented new Buddhas that would appeal to the Chinese. When they came to our part of the world, they created a Buddha that would appeal to the Jews. So he was, they pretended that there was a Jewish king called Jesus from Nazareth. See, they make new kings. Had they come to Denmark or had they come to Africa, they would have created the king of the Boers or of the
whatever
okay. tribe there may have been. That was the way they did it.
So yeah. if I understand you correctly, the reason that you say that the Buddhists got to the Jews is because when these texts were written down in the West, then we find that these texts are all about Jews. So that's how you make that connection. Okay.
Yes, because the New Testament is about the Jewish king.
But is it possible that the Jews modified the Buddhist texts, or are the two exactly the same, or is it just that you can pick up some inspiration comes directly from the Buddhist texts and then it moves on into a story of its own? I just want to clarify
good
that.
Question. Good question, and I will give you an example of something that is quite very puzzling. There are more than 30 parables in the Greek New Testament. And it has been difficult to identify these parables, but I think I have identified quite a few of them. I will tell you why it is, has been difficult. You remember the parable of the rich young man who wants to enter the kingdom of God or the kingdom of the heavens. And what can I do, he says to Jesus, in order to enter the kingdom of the heavens? And then Jesus says, you must follow the commandments and give away what you have to the poor. And then Jesus says, the young man, he becomes very sad. And Jesus says, well, it is easier for a camel to enter the eye of the needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God.
Yeah,
now,
I've heard this.
When I read this in Greek, it suddenly struck me that I had read this parable before, and I did. But the parable in Buddhism runs as follows.
Yes.
The context is, it is very difficult to be reborn as a human being, because, as you know, Buddhists believe in rebirth. Yes. And you can be reborn as a cow, or as a bird, or as a lizard. But it's very, very difficult to be reborn as a human being. It presupposes that you behave very well, that you amass good karma. Okay, and then the Buddha comes with a parable. He says, it is extremely difficult and rare to be reborn as a human being. It is like, imagine, out in the ocean, deep down in the waters of the ocean, there is a turtle. And this turtle, every now and then, it needs to have a bit of air, and then, for instance, with an interval of a week or a day, I don't know, and then it sticks up its head and its neck, and as it just happens, there is a yolk flowing on the ocean with a hole in the middle, a yolk, and this turtle just happens to stick its neck through the hole of the yolk. And this, when I read this in Sanskrit, it sounds so-and-so.
Wow.
And when I read it in Greek, it sounds the same. But then you can see that the turtle has become the camel, and the hole in the middle of the yolk has become the hole in the needle.
Okay.
So it's perfect. It's perfect. And the rich man, he is in Greek, plousios, and the man is in Sanskrit, purushas.
Hmm.
Okay. So they sound the same. So they are making, to put it roughly like that, bizarre or strange, but accurate translations.
Okay. Give me some more examples of things that you found of translations, so that this is very...
There is the parable of the sower. The man, the farmer who throws the seeds, he goes out on his in the field and throws seeds. Some seed fall in the ground, some seeds fall on stone, some yes. seed fall on barren ground, and some on the road. That's a mad farmer, a sower, S-O-W-E-R, a sower. Yes. That is a very famous parable in the New Testament.
Yes, that,
so we ask ourselves, yes, what kind of bizarre person is this? Is he drunk or how? Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Why does he sow in such a weird way? Doesn't he know where to actually put his stuff? Okay.
Okay. And in Greek, in fact, the Greek verb is a spiron, and it actually means sow, but it also means spread. So he's a spreader, also one who spreads things. And that then, once you see this, then you know, if you know the Sanskrit, then you know that Sanskrit poets, they speak of clouds. Indians are very interested in clouds because in the dry weather, they're looking for the cloud to come and spread or shed water, right?
Okay.
And then the Sanskrit original is speaking of a cloud that sheds the drops of water. And then it is quite natural that some of the drops fall on the road
on
barren ground.
Okay, yes. Now that's interesting. So we can see the concept in its original form, and then they turn it into something else. And it sounds almost like maybe they even mistranslate some of it or struggle to translate it, like spreader versus sower.
You're quite right. I might say that they deliberately want to confuse us. I could come with many more examples, but these are two good ones. There are many more examples where you can only conclude that they are deliberately, they want to confuse us. And then I don't know the answer to why in the world do they want to do this. Is it because the original authors were encouraging the young students to learn the original language? Was that the reason? I don't know. But I pose it as a question. Why did they deliberately make strange, bizarre translations? Then I pose as a question.
Could it also just have been that maybe they are not very good? They can't read it properly?
No, that could not be. And here's something else which is also new and might confuse. It is as follows. When we read the Greek text of the New Testament, then a colleague of mine, now a Dutch scholar, he passed away some years ago, called Smit Sebinger, very little known, but a Dutch scholar. Yeah. See, he had made a very surprising set of observations.
Yeah.
Namely, he had started to do something very odd, namely counting words and syllables of the Greek text of the New Testament.
Okay.
So you have various words, and then you can take one chapter. Then he had counted the number of words and the number of syllables. That's easy enough. And then he had pointed out that there is a deliberate symmetry. Say, the chapter could consist of 300 words and then of precisely 600 syllables.
Okay.
So there's a ratio, he pointed out, between the number of words and syllables.
In all the Gospels?
He gave 10 or 15 examples of the Book of Acts and of various passages in the Gospels, sufficient to establish the rule that the authors counted words and syllables. And this was in response to your possible objection, Jan, that could it have been that they weren't very professional? The answer is they were highly professional mathematicians.
Could this be related to the whole concept of numerology? That there are numbers and meanings to the numbers?
Exactly.
So could it then be that some of the translations have to be modified in order to fit in with their numerology requirements?
In a certain sense, yes.
possible. Okay, so the point is, your argument is it's deliberate. It cannot be by accident. Yeah. Definitely not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And I will give you one very striking example that Jesus is called Lord. Lord Jesus. Jesus Christ, our Lord. Okay?
Okay.
Now, Jesus, like any other word in the New Testament, has a number. And that number you find in the following way. The Greeks did not use numbers in the same way that we did, but the Greeks, they used letters as numbers. And so they get Jesus is spelled I or J, and the J then has a numerical value of 10. And then they have the A, he is called in Greek Jesus, six letters. So 10 plus 8 plus 200 for S plus 70 for O and then 400 for U and 200 again for S. That added up to 888. So okay. The number of Jesus is 888. And this is not something that I'm making up, because there are a few early church fathers who write, don't you know that the number of Jesus is 888? So this was known to certain Christians, that the number of Jesus is 888. Fine. Now, let us see what we can figure out here. Let us draw a circle that is 888. The circumference is 888. Then we can, as mathematicians, if we draw an inscribed square, I hope you have had good teaching of mathematics in South Africa.
Probably.
Okay. If we draw the inscribed square, it will be 800 units. I mean, we started with Jesus 888 as a circle. We could be centimeters or meters or kilometers, doesn't matter. In any case, if the circumference is 888, then for sure, it cannot be otherwise, the inscribed square will be 800. But 800 is the number you have of Lord, Kyrios in Greek, 20, K-U-R-I-O-S. That is 20, 400, 100, 10, 70, 200. That's 800. That means, Jan, when you draw the circle with the square, then you have sort of, say, the mathematical or geometrical proof that Jesus is the Lord.
Okay, you lost me a little bit on that because of your term inscribed square. I'll have to look that up, but I sort of understand.
Yeah, a regular square with the 90 angles, 4 times 90 degrees. So a very normal square and then a circle around, very simple, or I could make the cross. If you draw the cross in the circle, the cross will be 565, and that is for the Greek is. So you read the circle with the cross. It's Jesus.
Okay, I'll have to look a bit more, but I quickly had a quick look at what an inscribed square is. I sort of get it, but okay.
Okay. Yeah. But you know what the diameter of a circle is, of course. And then the diameter has a certain number when the circle has a certain number. So all this is hinting at the texts were written by mathematicians. That is the point. And you see, this is very nice because it's not been a theory of mine. It's not something I suggest. It is something that anyone can check out for himself in his own study.
Okay. You've hit on a lot of stuff, and we're going to come back to a lot of these things, because I'm also going to tell this to one of my academic friends that I told you about, the guy who used to be the university lecturer, because now you're hitting into interesting stuff. And you personally are able to read ancient Greek and Sanskrit and Pali.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, because I have a doctorate, a real doctorate. I had to study 2,000 pages of Sanskrit and Pali, and I was hired by the Academy of Sciences to do a dictionary of the Pali language. So I'm not fooling you. I mean, my name is Yeah. So no doubt about that. You can check that on the internet. I'm considered one.
That is, you see, that is now fascinating. We've
it
still,
is.
I think, let's chat for about another 10 minutes or so. Give me some other examples of things that you saw in Sanskrit, which you then saw in the New Testament. This is very interesting.
Yeah. One more example of this mathematical thing is that on the whole, the three first Gospels tell more or less the same story. But there is some so-called sunder stuff. In some cases, only one evangelist has an episode. For instance, Luke is the only one to report the visit of Jesus to Martha and Mary. He visits Martha and Mary. Only Luke. It is chapter 10:40-something. Chapter 10:40-something.
Okay.
And here I found the similar episode. The Buddha, along with his disciples, coming to a village where they meet a woman called Amrapali. She is a courtesan or a prostitute. This story in the Sanskrit original consists of 46 syllables, and in the Greek it also consists of 46 syllables. Isn't that nice?
Oh, wow.
Mm. Yes, that's nice. And that really proves the point. That proves the point that it's not just some Buddhist ideas that are flowing in the air that then come to our part of the world. No, no. We are dealing with people who are sitting down there and with their finger, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. For sure.
My goodness. So
yes.
Now, in terms of the New Testament, we don't, all that we can surmise is that the New Testament was written by Jews.
By Buddhist missionaries. So it's very, I cannot say anything about the racial identity. It's simply, it was written by people who wanted to promote Buddhism in a very odd way, as we briefly showed with these puzzling ways of translating. Not wanting to reveal their identity, but to promote the general idea of a person who sacrificed himself for the benefit of mankind. Because that is the very special thing about a Buddha and about Jesus, but not about any Jew before that. That is the essence of Christianity. This man, the Son of God, who sacrifices himself for the benefit of mankind. And that is precisely the definition of a Buddha in India and in China. He is a man. And therefore, of course, he was successful. Because you might also ask the question, how come the Jesus story was so successful? It's unique. The Greeks didn't have such a loving God who sacrificed himself for mankind. You see, that is the key to the success of the Christian story. He loves you.
Okay, because now that you say the Buddha sacrifices himself, I was unaware of that whole angle. And you say that he was crucified. Tell me about the crucifixion in Sanskrit.
Okay.
What happens there?
I mentioned to you that Buddha, in the book called Buddhism's Relation to Christianity, or was it Christianity's Relation to Buddhism? It's Christianity's Relation to Buddhism. Came out, I think, 6 years ago by Michael Lockwood, Professor Michael Lockwood. Okay. Then at the end of the book, you have the story of crucifixion in Sanskrit and in English. And it is briefly like this, as far as I recall, that there is a certain king. He has two sons. One of them becomes his successor. Both of them are princes. Only one becomes his successor. And the other one desires to live the life of an ascetic in the wilderness. Then something odd happens to this poor man, because there is a prostitute called Bhadra, and various things happen, and then this poor prince who didn't want to be his father's successor is arrested for having murdered the prostitute. He is, however, innocent. He is innocent. And then he is, for the murder that he did not commit, he is condemned to be crucified and led away. And then they describe his dress. He has a crown of thorns, which is an Indian idea.
What? The crown of thorns is an Indian idea?
Yes, when you read people who are to be executed. And he is dressed, and then the dress is described. And then he is put up on the cross, and then he has a conversation with his former teacher, just as Jesus has a conversation. And then eventually the king, you know, the person who is called, strangely enough, Potella, much like Pontius Pilate, Potella, he recognizes that he did a serious mistake. He comes, the man was innocent, and he cries, "What can I do? I have had, and I condemned an innocent man to crucifixion. What can I do?" That is one of the stories. And then, like I said, told you before, sometimes, and that makes it difficult to take the traces. And that is, this one is perhaps easier. Then they have these unknown authors of the Gospels, when writing the story of the crucifixion, used an other text. And the other text is easy for all of those to listen here, trace and verify what I'm now going to say. It is called the Lotus Sutra. Lotus Sutra. And you can check that out on your computer, and then you will find there is an English translation from 1885 by a Dutch scholar called Kern, K-E-R-N. And then you want to very, very easy to find, chapter 11. And in chapter 11, you will see the story of our Buddha, the historical Buddha, is preaching the gospel, the Lotus Gospel, to his disciples. Then suddenly a miracle occurs. Up from the earth emerges a so-called stupa. Stupa, you know, this Buddhist building, a sort of Buddhist temple. And it hovers up in the air. And then from inside that stupa, a voice is heard. And that voice says, "Sadhu, sadhu, Bhagavan Shakyamuni." When you then compare this to the words from the cross, Jesus says, "Eli, eli, lema sabachthani." And then that is Aramaic. And then that's translated into Greek, which is Timu, Timu. It is a clear echo of the original Sanskrit, and it has the same numbers, like I mentioned before, okay, the Luke passage. And then everybody is astonished in the Sanskrit. That is chapter 11 of the Lotus Sutra. All of you check it on the net there. And everybody is astonished. And then the monks ask the Buddha, "What was this strange voice? What's inside this stupa?" And then the Buddha uses one of his fingers on his right hand, sort of as a knife, and cuts open this stupa. And inside the stupa is sitting an ancient Buddha. He was the one who said, "Sadhu, sadhu, Bhagavan Shakyamuni, lema, lema, eli, eli, lema sabachthani." And this, you can easily imagine this, his finger being used as a knife, cutting up the stupa so that it opens almost like a sip, right? And if you remember in the gospel, it says that when Jesus spoke these words from the cross, the curtain of the temple split from top to bottom. And in the Sanskrit, it splits from bottom to top.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. Very interesting.
And then the next things that happen.
Okay.
Yeah. And then suddenly there's an earthquake, and this makes it all very clear. There's an earthquake, and then the graves open, and millions of holy men emerge from the graves in order to spread Buddhism. And there you can see in Matthew, suddenly there's an earthquake, and the holy men emerge from their graves. So there's no doubt about it. It's such a curious incident. It's
wow.
A poppy.
That yes. is strange. And now I want to ask you a final question. I think because I'm going to go through some of the stuff you've mentioned. I want to put this on my website quite soon, and I'll send you the details. But I want to ask you now, you talk about crucifixion. And my understanding of now the Christians depict crucifixion as a cross and people being nailed to the cross, which is itself physically impossible. And my university lecturer friend, he was telling me, well, first of all, the people known for crucifixion, as far as I know, are the Romans. Yeah. And he told me that the way that – and the Romans at various times crucified people, and sometimes they even crucified tens of thousands, as at the time of the slave revolt, for example. Now, he said to me that basically crucifixion was probably a case of tying a guy to a pole and breaking his ribs with an iron bar. That is probably what crucifixion really was like. But you describe crucifixion in India. How the heck is that possible? Where does that come from?
That's a good idea. Actually, well, when I said crucifixion, I used our term. The Sanskrit term is shilan. He was impaled on a stake. We have Assyrian inscriptions and, on Syrian reliefs, you see this... thing of people can be staked on a stake, be impaled on a stake. So the Sanskrit speaks of being impaled on a stake. And you may remember, I think it's in the book of Acts, there it is said that Jesus was impaled on a stake. This means that the cross as a symbol does not come in from Buddhism here. But it does come in nevertheless. And I don't know if our Danish friend is listening, but she will be delighted to see that what has happened is that the Buddhist swastika turns up as a cross. That's a sort of a long story, but already in early Buddhist art, we see the feet of the Buddha bearing the symbol of a swastika. And somehow this swastika is translated or transformed into the cross. I could really explain why it would be the cross. It has to do with some puns on the Greek word for a stauros, a cross, and puns on sutram, and so on, but that it would take perhaps half an hour. One could do that
we'll focus on
the transformation.
Some of these things. I just want to check with you. Did you say that in the book of Acts that Jesus is impaled on a stick, on a stake?
Yeah.
So we can find that in the Bible.
Yes, that is, the Greek is shulon, on he was impaled on a stake, shulon in Greek, and the Sanskrit is shulam, so which means the same. So it's very, very clear. So so it explains the inconsistency. On the one hand, we usually have stauros, a cross, but we also have at least one case in the New Testament, in one of the other books, of a stake, a shulon, on a tree. You can also translate this as a tree, on a tree.
Okay, because I'm quickly having a look on the internet, and I see that there are people already, they talk about Acts 5:30, and they say, many are surprised to read in many Bibles that Jesus was hung on a tree. So
That's right. So here you have the explanation, Jan.
Okay, so there's an inconsistency in the Bible that matches the Sanskrit.
And that is a common argument I can make, that this looks paradoxical in the Greek and in the New Testament. But when you know the Sanskrit source, the paradox disappears.
Okay. Okay. I think we
like with the turtle.
I think we've touched on a lot of hectic stuff here, and we're gonna have to talk again. You've really thrown a bunch of things at me that I think are very fascinating. So
yes.
I've got your email address. I will pop you an email the moment that I put this up on my website, and I'm going to try and get it out within the next day or so. This is fascinating. You've truly told me some interesting things. So, because if there are those funny things that a Christian can go and check in the Bible, that's important. That's very important for a Christian. And I think that is something we need to come back to. That is fascinating. I like that thing from Acts. I really do. That's going to make for interesting reading.
Well, I very much appreciate that you understand and that you appreciate too. Danish priests would do the same.
well, you know what could be happening easily, my friend, is that it's not that people don't appreciate, it's that they are threatened by what they see there. They know that this thing is a problem. You know what's an interesting story that I'm gonna refer to my friend the way that I always refer to him. I call him my Boer Nazi pal. Now he's the guy who was a university lecturer, and he tells me the following. He says the following thing. He said to me, "Look, in South Africa, all the priests, all the guys who become priests in the Afrikaans Church, they all go to university." They actually go to university and they study philosophy, and they study properly and they get a proper education. And he said to me that when those priests go and they get their education, they come out of there knowing full well that the things that they're going to teach people are not true. They know the proper academic definitions of things. They know that what they're going to teach people is not scientifically correct. It's not actually correct. But they're going to go and make a career out of that. And he said to me that he's asked these guys, you know, how are you going to do this? You're going to go and teach people stuff that you know is not true. And they just say to him, well, it's a profession. It's a career. And that, I think, is one of the problems that some of the Christians face. And I will tell you something. Here in South Africa, the church has been going downhill among the Boers. The Afrikaans people have been turning away from the church because they used to really believe everything that they were told is true.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many of them turning away from it. They are mainly turning away from the church, but not from the Bible. They rather than turn to the Bible as their source, but they are very angry with the church as an institution. That is where this thing has been hitting home in recent years. Very interesting.
Yes, I appreciate your observation. My observations would be exactly the same here. Only I don't think there are so many who would read. They turn away from the church, even though they're members, but don't know what it's all about. Perhaps for old time's sake. But only Jehovah's Witnesses really know their Bible.
Is that so? Only the Jehovah's Witnesses? Yeah. Why do you say that?
Jehovah's Witnesses, they believe in the Bible word for word. They do think it's a direct word of God. But the average Dane is member of the church, but does not know what's going on. And it's ritual. I think the most people would say, no, we really don't believe, but we like to have the church. And that has to do with the fact that we have these 2,000 ancient churches from around roughly 800 years old. So they look very nice in the landscape, and there's something sentimental about it.
Okay.
But I have spoken to so many bishops and professors, and I can affirm what you say, that in the university, they tell one story and they don't believe in these stories. But when they come out in the church as priests, they tell stories they don't believe in. So that is correct what you're saying. That also applies here.
Excellent, excellent. So that is, because that's exactly what my university lecturer friend told
me. Right. He's right.
He said that they know that this is not true.
He's right.
They've learned it, and they've gone through all the proofs. They know exactly that. Wow. So
he knows.
So, yeah, because these people are just playing. They're just giving a story to the masses, and look, I mean. Tradition is one thing. Christianity has become the tradition of all European peoples. It's gone past the paganism. It's supplanted the paganism. And I think I also think my own observation. This is a personal observation. Is that I think that there's a lot of emotional need for this kind of stuff. In fact, I'd even go further. I'd even say the following, that this is a personal observation. I'd even say that Christianity is a woman's religion. It really appeals to women. It has an emotional attraction to women that it's what they want to hear. That they want to hear this.
Okay. Are you speaking black as well as white?
Well, I think across races, actually. I think it would be for all of them. I think for all of them. There's a certain emotional appeal, you know, because there's also God the Father. He loves us. He's going to take care of us. He's not going to allow nasty things to happen to us. There's somebody looking out for us. He's looking over us. And I think that is a huge part of Christianity.
You're quite right. And the proof is recently there's a woman called Charlotte Rert, not our Charlotte, that she wrote a book which has become somewhat of a bestseller. It's called I Met Jesus.
What?
And she even, I Met Jesus.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And she manages to draw huge crowds into the otherwise empty churches.
That is
because
interesting. Look, there are all kinds of
things. You're quite right. These women, they Jesus loves me. That's the essence. Jesus loves me.
You know, and it's got to probably, it's also probably fueled by insecurity and they maybe don't have strong men anymore. They don't believe in things.
Yeah.
They need to feel safe. I've noticed it as a general concept. They probably feel very unsafe in the world. And it is a brutal world. Make no mistake. I do understand a little bit of Nietzsche, and I do understand the world is freaking. And from history, that is the way the world is. Well, Christian, it was a really fascinating discussion that we've had. I'll try and get this out in the next day, and I'll send you the link. And I'm definitely going to take this up with my university friend. He's going to be the first guy that I want. I actually want him to listen to what you've discussed here. And I'm going to start digging into these things.
I think it can be very fruitful. It can be very fruitful.
Yes.
And I shall be willing to assist and be ready. Yes.
And then let me talk to him. Let's look at things, because I think what we'll need is some follow-ups where I need to raise things with you and you answer more questions. Because all these things are fascinating, because the whole concept of religion, where it came from, what its purpose was, and how these stories were built. My friend in particular, his focus has been studying the myths of the Middle East. And that's where he drew lots of stuff from, and his stuff also, like yours, ties back to other scientists and academics who've really been studying, and they've found all kinds of things, you know. But I think your Sanskrit link, oh man, this is a whole different thing. To say that this came from India, And this is the cross-pollination of Europe to India. This is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Quite right. I'm very happy that you appreciate and you put so good questions there. Very good. Very good, Jan.
Thank you very much. And we'll be chatting again soon. So that was my interview with Dr. Lindner, and I hope you enjoyed it. I went and checked with regard to Bible verses, and two Bible verses that people need to go and take a look at is Acts 5:30 and Acts 10:39. Go and look at all the various versions of the translations of those two verses. And if you go to a place like BibleHub.com, you can go and look at the various translations of this, and you will see that in some translations of the Bible, they talk about Jesus having been hung in a tree. And this is very similar to what my Boer Nazi pal told me about crucifixion and what scientists know about crucifixion. In other words, this shows you that there are some translation problems and there are things that are not quite exactly the way that you've been led to believe. That there are some hints that there is another form of crucifixion and it's not at all the same as the crucifixion that you're used to that is in the Bible. So anyway, some very fascinating stuff. And I hope you enjoyed it and you'll think about it. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.